Most of you, I am sure you already have heard about the Planck results, so I will try to show you a few things that you may have not already heard. So of course I have to start by a global view of the Planck satellite, the Planck mission. So it's the first European satellite dedicated to the relic radiation, to the CMB, so after COBE and WMAP of course. And it has been entirely designed to be ultimately sensitive in temperature. So it was really the goal about more than 20 years ago. And then we had more features to be sensitive to polarization. And the goal was also to provide the first full sky in polarization with a good sensitivity. So the mirror is 1.5 meters. So it defines the angular resolution, which is about 5 minutes, 5 arc minutes. And it has two instruments, a low frequency one, under Italian supervision, which is called down at 20K. So I won't talk a lot about it because at first I belong to HFI, so I know much more things about HFI. And also LFI is not very far from WMAP, so we have learned much more new things from HFI. So HFI is the other instrument, which works at 0.1K, so it's cooled down at a very, very cold temperature, and it's the most important technical challenge of the old satellite. It's under the French supervision, and for the French people, it's really a huge collaboration and mission because we were many people highly involved in this project. So the collaboration involved about 600 people, from Europe mainly, but also for US, and from Canada with people from Toronto and Montreal and Vancouver. So few people are deeply involved also in Planck. So before showing you the results and so on, I must remind you that the data are available. So all what I will show, you can do it again if you want, most of it. So you have to use the easiest way is to use PLA Planck in Google or Lambda, and you will have these very nice pictures, and you will have the maps, cosmology, and other things which may perhaps you will be less interested in, and the explanatory supplement which explain what is in the maps and so on. So 2 years ago we provided only temperature from the nominal mission, so two full sky. And now we have temperature and polarization, full mission. So it's 8 full sky for LFI and 5 for HFI. And it was less compact, the delivery, than for temperature, with results in December, February, July. But now we have everything. And next year we should deliver an improved polarization version. Many, many maps are available. You can sync to frequency map, foreground maps, CMB maps, of course. So as an example, for the CMB, we provide results with 4 component separation methods, which allow to check your results. And we also divide in time the mission for the full mission, nominal mission, per survey, so 6 months, per year, per half mission. All this is very powerful to check the results and to check the robustness of the results. We also provide masks, for instance, and you see that we have 100% of the sky, but for cosmology we use much less. So I will show only very few things about LFI, but I think that it's nice to have an idea of a radiometer. So here is the horn, so the light comes from here. And here is the cold electronic at 20K, and it compares the signal from the sky and from a reference which is at 4K. So it differs from WMAP, which also uses radiometers. We compare 2 points of the sky. Here we compare sky and the reference, which is very stable. And then it goes inside the service module to have the last part of the electronic and so on. 2 channels are dedicated to foreground, 1 to CMB, and that's all. For HFIs, the detectors are bolometers, so we have two kinds of bolometers. The SWBs for spider web bolometers, which are sensitive to temperature only. All frequency has, each frequency has SWB except the first channel at 100 gigahertz. And we also have pairs of PSB, so of polarization sensitive bolometers. So here you have the superposition of two bolometers, one in this direction with each, which with his thermometer, and the other one in this direction with the other thermometers. And we have PSB for all CMB channels and the first foreground channel, 353 gigahertz. We also have two dark bolometers, so they don't see the sky. It's used to, for the analysis, to see the instrument itself, in fact. So this is the payload. So at the center, you have HFI, which is cooled down at 100 milli-K, surrounded by HFI with bigger horns because the frequency is lower. And so this is the instrument. Then we have three V grooves. So it's the first cooling down stage, passive one, which allows to go from about 300K to 30, 40K. Then we have a first cooling machine working with hydrogen, which cooled down everything at 20K. It's in two, so we have two cooler at 20K for redundancy because it's really the first part, and if it does not work, nothing can be used. Then we have the only moving part of the satellite, the 4K cooler, which works with helium, which cooled down the horns of HFI and the reference for LFI. And then we have the helium 3 and helium 4, which goes very close to the instrument, and then it is mixed, and it allows to cool down the HFI bolometers at 100 milli-K. Then it goes to space, and it determines the lifetime of HFI. When the spheres are empty, it's over. Then we have the service module with everything electronic, everything to communicate with the Earth, to move the satellite, and so on. And also things to have a very solid mechanical equipment, screens to protect from other signals, and that's it, and the two mirrors. So Planck is at the L2 point, so the Lagrange 2 point, which is in the axis Sun-Earth. It's a very good place to observe the universe. WMAP was there, Gaia is there, Euclid will be there, and so on. It's really comfortable for satellite. So Planck is not looking towards a direction and then moving to another one. It rotates on itself at one round per minute. So it was like this since the launch, just before it was left alone. And so it just scan and look in front of him. So in fact, it describes about 40 to 70 circles which are exactly identical. And then it slightly moves, and it moves so to follow the movement of the Earth around the Earth, around the Sun, sorry. So this period of identical circles are called rings. And it's a very important part of all the Planck analysis. We have circles, we have rings, and then we have maps per year survey and so on. And so this is just a way to map the sky, with here the sky invisible and by Planck. So this is the main steps of the data analysis for everything. So here you see the measurements. So it's about 1/6 of the moon, of the size of the moon, and shows we move. So each detector sees about what is in one circle and then in the other one and so on. So we have two collaboration, one for LFI and one for HFI. And we worked in parallel because it's different instrument, different systematics effect. So we just share the pointing. But except for that, we have to work independently. to correct from the instrument response and to build the maps. I will go back to these steps. Then we put all the maps together and we can build catalogs of sources, maps of astrophysical components, and then we analyze these maps, especially the CMB map. We characterize it and derive about 6 or 10 or 20 cosmological parameters. So at the beginning, we have 1,000 billion of measurements because here it's for a nominal mission, it's twice more, and at the end, about 10 numbers. So this is the HFI focal plane and how it works for our measurement. A measurement, what the signal we have, it's a mix of astrophysical signal, which is described by the intensity and the Q and U Stokes parameters for the polarization. It's linked to the sky by the pointing matrix. We also have a noise, of course, and here some parameters which depends on the detector. Here the angle. So for instance, here you see the focal plane. When you only have a circle, it's a SWB, and when you see a cross, it's a PSB with the orientation of the two bolometers. So this depends on time, and this depends on the detector. It's roughly 1 for PSB and 0 for SWB. Thanks to the scanning strategy, each pixel is visited with the two main directions. During one survey, it will be crossed, for instance, like that, and the second, so the next survey, like this. So it's only what we have, except near the ecliptic pole, where it's more, it scans with many more directions. So we cannot recover Q and U for one single detector in Planck. We have to combine several detectors. And so it's very important to keep it in mind because many systematics arise from that. So this is RUTOI. So TOI means time ordered information. Here you have three circles, so 3 minutes about. For one bolometer sensitive to the CMB, one to the galaxy, and one is dark. And you see clearly the dipole, but also you see a lot of spikes, which comes from the cosmic rays hitting the detectors. So we, at the beginning, we expected about few per minute. We had and only big ones, and in fact, we had about 1 per second, and some of them are very small. There are some that you cannot almost see. So it was a nightmare from the beginning to take care of that. So this is a schematic view of the HFI data processing. So in yellow, you have the data themselves, the raw data, and here what is delivered, the TOI, which are available. The beam products to describe the beams, the maps, and some ancillary maps, which can be used if you want to do special things with the data. And each box corresponds to something to do with the data. When it's blue, it means that it has been improved or added with respect to the last release, so with the 13th release for temperature. At the very, very beginning, we have to add a new step, which is the ADC correction. So it's a correction of the readout electronics at the very beginning, just after the bolometers themselves. And it was the most important thing which has been done because thanks to this improvement, all other things were able to be improved. We have to remove the glitches, so it's done at the ring level. So here, everything is done at the ring level. We subtract the baseline, so there is no filtering at all. We correct from the gain. So for that, we use a thermal template. I will show you it. So this is a thermal decorrelation. We also have to remove the 4K lines. So I told you that the 4K cooler has the only moving parts of the satellite, and it induces signals at the electronic part, resonance, and it was another nightmare, much more than expected. And then we have We have to deconvolve from the time response to correct for some jumps, because sometimes for some rings, the baseline level has a jump. So now we correct for it. And then that's all for the TOI. And we can compute the maps. So we have to calify the detectors themselves with the beam products to reconstruct the focal plane. We have to know where each detector is, where it is looking. We have to compute the noise properties, and from all this stuff, we can compute the maps, calibrate them, and also there is a big step of data qualification. We had a huge amount of data with Planck. We have more than 2 years with only 50 detectors, but that's not so bad. So really, the idea is to keep only very good data. And if there is something that we don't understand or we understand why it does not work, we just discard it. And then from the maps, we have to extract special things like the zodiacal light. So the zodiacal light is the emission of the dust inside the solar system. It depends on time, because it depends on the position of Planck and of the Earth inside the solar system. So it must be computed and subtracted at the ring level. You cannot do it at the map level after. There is also the band pass mismatch. I will explain what it is afterwards. So this is all what has to be done. And of course, we do all this. We see some remaining problems. We try to understand. And we start again and again. So this is a thermal template. So don't care about the global value, the reference. It's only the shape which is important. So it's completely dominated by the sun activity. So this is as a function of the time, the full mission, the thermal template. And in fact, what we see is a number of cosmic rays hitting the bolometer plate. At the beginning, the sun was at the lowest activity with almost no sunspots. So the magnetosphere was very, very small and weak. And so a lot of galactic cosmic rays were able to reach the satellite. And after the sun was more and more active, the magnetosphere was stronger, and it was able to stop some of the galactic cosmic rays. And here, what you see is the solar flares. And here is when we change the 20K cooler to use the other one. The other main problem of the TOI processing was the 4K cooler lines. And we needed a lot of time to understand really what was the problem and so on. So here you have the spin frequency as a function of the ring number, so the time. And I told you that it rotates at 1 circle per minute. So it's really precise. But if you compute the spin frequency in millihertz, it varies slightly. You see it's a second or third digit. Nevertheless, sometimes for some frequencies, here you have the list of the frequencies, you are resonant with the spin frequency. And so the electronic signal come with the electronic inform yeah, signal come with the astrophysical signal, and so you cannot separate both of them. And moreover, it was the problem in the 2013 data. Some feature remained with the 30 Hz line, which impact at a multiple 118 1800s. So now we have we understand was that we don't understand the problem, but we know where it is. So we are able to discard the data which are contaminated, even if we absolutely not understand why for this line there is a special behavior.
How do you know there's a problem?
No, only this one. And also slightly this one, but we don't care. It's at a multiple more than 4,000, so we don't care.
When you say you know there's a problem, you don't know why there's a problem. How do you know there's a problem? What's
There is a, if you compute the amplitude of the line, this line for each bolometer, it's exactly the same for all detectors. and it varies very abruptly. We don't know why. It's only this line which has this behavior. So for the other one, in fact, we interpolate when because we have to know the part of the 4K lines only when it is in the astrophysical signal, and when it is in the astrophysical signal, we are not able to compute it. So we use the ring before and after to estimate the value, but for this line, as it varies abruptly, we don't know, and so we had a lot of problems. No, no, it was not seen before. But it's, and it cannot be tested on the ground because on the ground you don't have signal. So you don't have this problem. You cannot find it. And you need a lot of data and so on. It was not rotating on Earth. So we never had it. So this is the statistics of the discarded data. So here it's the bolometer numbers, names, and here is the fraction of discarded data. So about 70% of the data are usable for astrophysics and cosmology only. So we lose 30% of the data. So the green shows what is discarded for the with glitches, so cosmic rays impact. So it varies from 10 to about 20% depending on the bolometers. And then in blue, it is what is discarded at the sample level. So it varies from also one bolometer to another one. It's mainly the pointing, because when we change from one wing to another one, we lose a few minutes when we have to wait that the stable is completely the pointing is completely stable. And also there are some maneuvers and so on, so sometimes we lose some data. And here in black, it's the total amount of discarded data. You see that it's almost the same for some bolometers. It means that we only lose a few rings due to solar flares or the change of the cooler and so on. It's not a lot at all. And for some rings, we have some RTS, so random telegraphic signal, from time to time, so for this one, for example. And all this one, it's because of the 30 Hertz lines. So we see that it impacts heavily the 217 gigahertz channel. It's why the 30 Hertz line had a visible impact on the 217 map. So this is clean TOI. So just to show you, so we see the dipole, the galaxy, and here it's very, very stable. You see only noise because thermally the detectors are really, really stable. Of course, you don't see the CMB anisotropies, even if these detectors are extremely sensitive. We see the noise from the photons themselves, and we have to combine many measurements to see the anisotropies. We also have to qualify the detector answer. So it's a very complex task. We use Mars, Saturn, and Jupiter, and we have to use several planets with several fluxes to be able to track the core, the main beam, the central part of the main beam with Mars. It's a quite strong signal, but also Mars is close, so it's moving inside a ring. So it scans very efficiently the core of the beam. Then we use Saturn for a larger part, and then Jupiter for, let's say, the rings of the beams. And then we also have to compute the time constant of the bolometer. So the time constant are computed in order to have a symmetric signal. So this is the scan direction. So the scan direction, we go like this. This is a cross-scan direction. And we try to find the time constant, which allows to have a symmetric signal before and after the beam, so which means to have no signal here. there is something, but as you can see from the color scale, it's really a very low part. So the two fastest time constants come from planet observation. Then we have to stack glitches, millions of glitches, to determine the time constant for the next time constant. So here it's about tenths of milliseconds. Here it's about hundreds of milliseconds. And the amplitude is fitted with the Jupiter signal. And then for the fifth one, which is also an improvement, an important difference with respect to the 2013 results, we use the stacked glitches still, but we fit the amplitude on the CMB dipole shift. So it's a kind of leakage of the dipole due to the fifth time constant, which can reach 1 second. And they're also more complicated for the 353 gigahertz. So this is the beam size. So you see that from 217, we have 5 arc minutes and slightly more before, as expected. The calibration, it's also an important improvement with respect to the previous result. So here you have the time in terms of ring number and the relative gain. So here we compute again per ring, and we check if it's stable. In the previous release, we were almost at the percent level. So being at the percent level is not so difficult. Being at the per mil level is really hard. So many, many improvements were needed to have it. The highest frequencies are calibrated with Uranus and Neptune, so these planets. And for the CMB channels, now it's calibrated with an orbital dipole. Before, it was calibrated with the WMAP solar dipole. And it was the origin of the discrepancy between the Planck and the WMAP level at the first peak amplitude. So now we are more sensitive, and we are able to use the calibrated the orbital dipole, which is known as the 1/1 million. So extremely precisely, but it's 10 times less less in amplitude than the solar dipole. And we have our own solar dipole, which is fully compatible with the WMAP one, but slightly shifted. To qualify the maps and to know if the data are okay and can be confident in them, of course, we cannot look at the signal because we don't know the signal. We don't know what it should be. So we have to compute the noise, and we know what the properties of the noise should be. So in fact, we use much more time to compute noise instead of signal. So here you have a spectra, so with the multiple as a function of the CL in TT and EEE. And we use different ways to cut the signal to estimate the noise. And it allows to see different properties and to see different problems eventually. So we can use half rings. So for half rings, we use 1 circle over 2. So instead of having 30 circles per ring, we have, instead of having 60 circles per ring, we have only 30. And we compute everything, all maps and so on, with this half data. We subtract one map to the other one, and we compute the noise. We do the same thing with the half mission. So it's easier, huh? The first part and the second part of the mission. And also, we do it for detector sets. So we use half of the detector. So this is done for the CMB channels. And you can perhaps see more or less that here it's slightly more important, about 10 to 20%. And it's because that we know that there are some correlation at the ring level, because the deglitching is done within a ring. And so computing the baseline inside the ring and using it to correct for the glitches introduces some correlation. And it's why We know that some there are some correlation between the two half rings. Another important thing is the detector set. So it's higher for all frequencies except the 100 gigahertz because we use only the PSB, so we use less detectors, so that's completely normal. So except for the red one. And never you see that it's highly compatible. And so when we have such noise spectra, we okay, at least we know what the noise is and it's reasonable. So this is the maps. So you probably already have seen them. So by LFI and by HFI, with a similar CMB sky and a galactic sky, of course, which depends highly on the frequency. So first, we have to extract catalogs, which also allow us to compute masks, because we don't want to look just behind the galactic center or the Magellanic Clouds. So we can do a lot of astrophysics with the catalogs. So there are a few hundreds of radio galaxies or blazars, so it's more LFI, but also the first channel of HFI. And it's the synchrotron emission by the inside the galaxy or inside the jets. It's really useful because it's unusual frequencies and multi-wavelength observations are always really needed to understand the physics of the objects. We have few thousands of galaxies which can be close or luminous and slightly more distant, or very distant and ultra-luminous ones. And it is, in fact, the thermal emission of the dust, exactly like our own galaxy. And we also have more than 70,000 galactic sources. So most of them are in the galactic plane, but also around. And it's mainly called molecular clouds, and it was detailed by the Herschel Observatory. So it was the reason of a common launch with Herschel and Planck, because Herschel should have been able to observe the Planck targets.
I know you explained it, but what's the cadence of these observations? Does it take a year to cover the whole sky?
No, the whole sky is about 6 months. It's 95% in 6 months.
I see. So the cadence, the sort of repeat time
Yeah, yeah.
for one of these galaxies would be something like 6 months or
Yeah,
something like
yeah.
that.
6 months is it's slightly more complicated to have the full part of the ecliptic pole because the way to scan the sky is not exactly something to cross only the ecliptic pole, but it's not far from that.
Thank you very
You're welcome. So then we have to separate the components. So here it's the frequency and the brightness of the source. So in blue, you have the CMB, and you see that even in temperature, the foregrounds are always higher or at the same level at the CMB. At high frequency, we see the thermal dust, and at low frequency, we have several emissions which are not thermal, free synchrotron, and the spinning dust. We also have, which was not really foreseen, the CO line emission. So it's due to the fact that there is not exactly the same bound pass between different detectors at the frequency of this line. And so we are able to see and to recover this emission, but it was not really foreseen. But we have to do it, and some astrophysicists are extremely happy with this data. So this is a map of the foregrounds in temperature. So the synchrotron, spinning dust, thermal, and the free, and here you have another line, and the three CO emission line. So one is much more intense. It is in the 100 gigahertz channel, the 217 gigahertz channel, and the 353. So the only one which is really important for the CMB is this one. And also there is a correlation on the position of all both. So it's the same mask. Then we get the intensity of the primary anisotropies for the CMB. So the sensitivity at the end is about 26 micro K per arc minute. We also are able now to derive the polarization. So for example, here is at the 143 gigahertz in Q and in U. And you see the scale, so it's 100 times less than for the sky in temperature. So this is at all frequencies. So a big challenge for the polarization is not only the detection, but also the visualization. We always have to choose one scale and to smooth, otherwise we don't see anything. But of course, in the data, you have everything. You can choose what you want to do with them. So here it's 1 degree smoothed. So the component separation in polarization, it is much more tricky because the CMB is always significantly lower than any foreground. Hopefully there are less foregrounds, only thermal dust and synchrotron are polarized. But you see that even at 100 gigahertz, you have about 3 times more thermal dust than CMB. So this is the two foregrounds, the synchrotron in Q and U, and the dust in Q and U also. And we can do something much nicer. So this is at 3453, we have a similar map from the 30 gigahertz map. And in fact, it allows to reveal directly the magnetic field direction. So when it is very irregular, you directly see the direction of the magnetic field. And when where it is more with circles and so on, you have in fact a mix because you see everything on the line of sight. So you have different direction along the line of sight. So it's much more difficult to interpret. Nevertheless, it's really useful to understand the galactic and magnetic field. An important thing, and it's the origin of the time delay of the release of the polarization data, is the foreground system, which induce systematics in the data. It was really hard to have data well understood and cleaned. And the problem is that we have a leakage from intensity to polarization. And it introduces very easily a fake polarization signal. And the intensity is so much more than the polarization signal that a very small intensity leakage produces a large polarization signal. So the problem can be a calibration mismatch. It's between the detectors of a given channel. And I've shown you that we compute polarization by mixing detectors. It can be zero-level problem and also bandpass mismatch, because any foreground with different spectral behavior will leak from intensity to polarization. And as an example, here is a CO map, the 100 gigahertz map, and you clearly see some features which are identical. So for analysis, you always have to map the CO with this data. So we had many problems at the very large angular scales, which are now solved, but mainly solved. But it's why it was so long to have the low frequency HFI, the low angular scale HFI data. And it was due to these leakages. So there are two ways to deal with that. We can use a theoretical bandpass mismatch or do a global fit with all things, all leakage, all foregrounds, all maps, and so on. So now we provide correction maps, which really should be used. The CU must be masked, and for the next release next year, everything will be corrected before.
Can I ask about that too? So this systematic is the intensity to polarization.
Yeah.
But you just showed us 2 slides ago that there's a polarization effect by the
polarization effect by the galactic magnetic field.
Mm.
So that must be a foreground source as well, the galactic magnetic field polarization, and that's polarization of polarization. So how do you correct for that, or do you correct for that?
It's because the signal is the same for all detectors, but the leakage is not the same for all detectors. It depends on the band pass, for instance, which at a small level, at the percent level, differs from one detector to the other, while the sky should be the same. So it's when they fit everything, the signal is the same for all detectors, but the leakage depends on each detector. So this is the Q&U for the CMB. So voilà, we have a Q&U for the whole sky. And this is so the polarized anisotropy, so with a small animation. And this way to show the polarization, which is quite nice, we try to show that we have a new information. An important thing is that we don't have used any interpretation of the data yet. We only use the fact that the CMB is a black body. That's all. And we know the its temperature. So now we can compare data with some models and to see if it fits. And we can do it already at the map level. And to do that, we stack the hot spots. Well, we can do it also with the of course, the cold spots. And we superimpose the thousands of small fluctuations, hotspots, and we compare the data and the simulation in each time in temperature, in Q, U, and another way to show the polarization with the direction of the polarization. And you see that it works pretty well with this simple lambda CDM model. Of course, more studies and parameters, the cosmological parameters are fitted using the power spectrum. So here is a full temperature power spectrum with the fit, with only six parameters. And we can also add ACT and SPT points. So it's other CMB instruments which have a much larger telescope, so with they see very small details, and you see that it fits pretty well up to a very, very large multiple. So the likelihood to compute and to interpret the spectrum have also really been improved. So we have six parameters, so the six parameters of the lambda CDM, and 11 nuisance parameters. So nuisance for CMB, it's the Sonnayev-Zeldovich effect, the CIB effect, and so on, so things like that. And also some calibration factor which can be fitted, and so on. So first, there is a joint temperature polarization likelihood, which is performed below L equals 30. And we have a smaller mask than before, so we use more of the, a larger part of the sky, so it's better to have more information at low L and to slightly reduce the cosmic variance. And then for the higher multiple, the signal is derived using the half mission. So I've shown you for the noise that we have several ways to compute the noise. We also have several ways to compute the signal. And the best, in fact, with the smallest amount of systematics, is to cross-correlate the half missions. In fact, with the half missions, you have two Planck missions. So that's simple and that's logical and it works really well. And also, we have improved our knowledge of the foreground. So here also, the mask is smaller. So this is the temperature, and each time I show you the residual at the bottom. So in TE and in EE. So it's not the same in EE, it's CL instead of DL, because to keep small error bars here. And you can see that it the agreement is quite good absolutely everywhere. I like very much to say that we have six parameters which reproduce really well the 19 peaks. This data contains the lensing information. So as you know, the light of the CMB is deflected by the clusters of galaxies along the line of sight. And so we have to take it into account. But also we can recover the information of the amount of mass and where is it. And so we can compute a map of the gravitational potential along the line of sight, mainly everywhere. The mass is rather small. And we can use it to know where is the matter about 2, 3 billion of years after the Big Bang. We can also compute the power spectrum of the lensing effect. So here is the power spectrum of the matter with Planck in gray and in orange, and the two other experiments which are sensitive at smaller scales. And you see it was a good agreement. So of course, it's not at all as precise as for temperature, but nevertheless, we have an information which can be cross-correlate with the distribution of clusters of galaxies and anything. The constraints on inflation. So I'm pretty sure that you know this much better than me. Perhaps it is your model. So if your model is here, it's very good for you. If this is your model, it's less good, as you want. And so we have R, the tensor to scalar ratio, which is lower than 0.11. And what is very important is that the NS factor is strictly lower than 1. So it's very good for all inflation models. The energy content, here also nothing really new. Of course, it's very similar to WMAP results because it's the same Lambda CDM model. What is very important is that now, thanks to the lensing, in fact, which gives you information when the CMB was emitted, but also 2 billion years after, with Planck alone, we already have very precise parameters and they do not move when we add more recent data like the BAO. So in fact, the improvement in precision is mainly due to the lensing because we have another information for that. And so now it's really stable and we can use these numbers when you do dark matter for anything, you can safely use it. The reionization, so it's something which is new with this release. Before we use the WMAP data in polarization, so we use their reionization results. The problem of the reionization, so it is the CMB photons, which are free after the CMB emission, interact with some electrons when the universe become reionized, presumably due to the first star's generation. The problem is that it's completely generated in temperature. We cannot know at all if we had a strong anisotropies with a strong smoothing or small anisotropies with a small smoothing. But hopefully, there is a unique signature in polarization. The problem is that it is at a very low multiple, around 10, even before 10. So there is a large cosmic variance, and also it's a part of the spectrum where the foregrounds were very difficult to estimate really properly. So the reionization optical depth is now about 0.67, and it corresponds to a redshift of 8.8. In fact, it's quite large still. If you translate it in years, it's between 400 and 800 million years. Nevertheless, it's later than what foreseen from the W map results, and slightly more precise. A new analysis, more detailed with newly cleaned maps, should be available before the end of this year. So quite soon.
What was the W map number for Z?
It was 11. And it was slightly even more at the very first results. These numbers are really in agreement with the astrophysical guess. And we know that it should be done completely, the reionization, at a redshift of 6. So the problem is that we would like to know if it's at the same time everywhere, if it is sharp or not, and it's at so small a multiple, so large scale, that it's not easy at all. We have a huge cosmic variance, and we have a small signal because it's late in the history of the universe, so the density of electron is small, so we have less signal, so we cannot do what we expected to do because there's no signal. So, of course, there is a Lambda CDM model, but we try to extend this simple model to see if we can do better. So we use temperature, lensing, and polarization. And so personally, it is my favorite plot. I like it very much. So this is omega lambda versus omega m. And the color refers to H0 value. And you see that you have, in fact, a lot of possible value for omega m, omega lambda, if you don't assume anything about the flatness or the h dot value. This is in temperature. With the black contours, you have things when you add polarization. This is temperature with polarization. And you see that with only this information, you can vary omega m by a very large factor of 2. If you add the lensing, then it's much smaller, because in fact you add another information 2 billion years later. And if you add the BAO, the baryonic oscillations, you have these very small red contours because you add information 10 billion years later. And here you have the number of the flatness of omega k, and it's really, really small, which is good for computation because in a Euclidean space it's always easier. It has been combined with a rather small value of h dot, smaller than what is computing using HST, for example, which is more around 72. Nevertheless, as you see, the constraint is very, very tight, and also there is no astrophysics in this measurement. It's very simple fluctuation evolution, so it's really safe in a sense. So in Planck, we are confident that it's good. The neutrino, of course, some people love neutrinos. So in the Lambda CDM model, we assume a null mass, 3 species, and no interactions. Something which is really nice is that we let free the parameter of the particle which was with the photons at the beginning of the universe. And we can see here the measurement values of NF, but also other things which characterize the way to interact between photon and this thing. And we see that it's precisely the expected value for the neutrinos. So in fact, we see primordial neutrinos interacting with primordial photons. So it's rather nice. We also can constrain the mass, lower than 23.23 eV. And we are happy with the 3 species. I think I have a plot after. This is a dark matter annihilation. So if there is annihilation of dark matter when the CMB is emitted, it is an input of energy at that time. And so it changes the time and the way to do the recombination. And so we should see some effect. So here it's a classical plot of dark matter with the mass of the particle as a function of the sigma v. Here is the values which were compatible with the dark matter explanation of the IMS Pamela data. It was in a rather strange scenario, and of course it was not the preferred explanation at all. But nevertheless, we see that it's ruled out by the Planck data, and it's a constraint which can be used with the other ones. Many other studies have been done, so many things at the map level. So studying the skewness, kurtosis, endpoint function, and Gaussianity in all ways you can imagine. So it's very, very hard job. And they found nothing, so it's okay. They did a lot of work, a beautiful work, but it's not famous because they didn't find any deviation from Gaussianity. And also other parameters of the standard model have been checked. We can also derive the helium and deuterium quantities. So usually we use the standard Bing-Bong nucleosynthesis values, but we can also let these parameters free, and we are in we get this this band, and we are in perfect agreement with. So here it's not highly constrained, but here it works perfectly well. And this is for the neutrinos, the number of neutrinos, so NF. So you can see that a fourth neutrino is not excluded by Planck, but it's not favored at all. And also because now it's something which is rather interesting, the equation of that state of the dark energy. So the contours, so the best contours in blue, so using CMB, BAO, and supernova and H-dot, they are smaller than before. You see that it's not very, very well constrained. If you see the scale here, W0 is between minus 1.2 and 0.8 or 7. So we have to do with it. Nevertheless, the standard value is perfectly compatible with the results. Other things now. There are many, many things in addition to the CMB in the Planck data, and even if we want to do cosmology. For instance, there is a cosmic infrared background. So when you look in some directions, in fields which are well known from extragalactic astrophysicists, you can see almost directly the extragalactic sky. And so we have looked in these fields and tried to recover this cosmic infrared background, which in fact is the sum along the line of sight of the emission of all the galaxies in the line of sight. So Planck are not able to resolve these galaxies with a beam of 5 arc minutes. It's not possible. Nevertheless, we see the sum of their emission, and we can do some physics with the anisotropies of this background. So here it should move, yes. So you will see here we change the frequencies, and you see that some sources appears and disappears progressively. It's because some sources, so some sources which dominates the fluctuation in one direction, are at different redshift. And so here you have, for example, a typical galaxy spectrum with the Planck channels. And of course, we see rather close galaxies at 857 gigahertz. And when you go down in frequency, you see more and more distant galaxies. And at 217, we are dominated by galaxies at a redshift larger than 2. Here you have the frequency also with the Planck range as a function of the brightness, let's say. And here it's the part, the contribution from a model of galaxies from different redshift. And you see that here we are dominated by galaxy at a larger redshift and here a smaller one. So by studying this spectrum and this data, we can constrain the star evolution over 10 billion of years. Of course, it's much more difficult to interpret than the CMB. The CMB, it's emitted at one time, and it is much easier. It's not astrophysics, so it's simpler, but it's beautiful data. We can compute so the CIB anisotropy spectrum. So here the CMB is a contaminant, also the galactic dust and the Sonnayev-Zeldovich emission. There is more than 2,000 square degrees from 11 fields which are used. And here, for instance, it's well fitted by a linear model plus shut noise, just the fact that we have a galaxy, so which is like a noise, and some home model of the galaxies. And we can use it to constrain the star formation rate and the bias parameter. So the bias parameter is a link between the fluctuation in terms of mass and the fluctuation in terms of number of galaxies. From the data, we can rule out that it does not depend on the redshift, which means that the number of galaxies does not reflect the same fluctuation of density as a function of the time. Here you have the star formation rate, here the effective bias as a function of the redshift. In the yellow, you have the constraint from the Planck CIB, and here you have some other observation. You see that it fits well, and we clearly see that the star formation rate is effectively very high between 1 and 2. And before we don't know yet very well, so we have to continue observation, and it can be a very important result also for future CMB observations if we are very, very sensitive. It's also compatible with the results from Spitzer and Herschel, which both are infrared satellites, which were able to resolve the CIB foreground. Another funny thing to do is to combine the CIB and the lensing. So the lensing sees the mass, and the CIB sees the baryons. And we can see if they are at the same place. So we do stacking from the CIB hot or cold spots, and we use the same places, of course, by stacking the lensing data, and it works incredibly well. It's really precise, and so it's also a way to check that the lensing effectively traces the mass, because we see baryons where the lensing says that there are some mass. Another way to study and to do cosmology is using the Sonnayev-Zeldovich effect. So the CMB photons are now used our test particle, and if a photon crosses a galactic cluster, his frequency is shifted to the blue part, and so his frequency changes, and if it does not encounter anything, it's not changed. So where we see a variation of the spectral distribution of the photons, it means that we have a galaxy clusters. It's linked to the number and the temperature of the electrons, so it's a way to characterize the baryonic matter. And an important thing is that it's totally independent of the distance cluster. Of course, if the cluster is more distant, it's smaller inside the beam, so it's more difficult to see the effect because we catch less photons. It's more diluted in the beams. Nevertheless, it's an important property. So Planck has been designed to see the AZ effect. Here you see this very special spectral property. So the photons of the smaller frequencies are taken at higher frequency, and there is a null effect at 217 gigahertz, a negative signal before and a positive after. Planck alone cannot say many things with these clusters, so we work with the XMM Newton Observatory, which allow to check if a cluster is effectively a cluster, and also to get the redshift. So this was the first supercluster discovered by AZ effect. So we have a catalog of now 163 clusters and superclusters. The catalog has two properties which are important: the purity, which means that what we provide are really clusters or superclusters. So we have, with the most constraining part, we have more than 90% of purity. And the other is a completeness, which means that we see, for example, 80% of all clusters, if we are above this line, 50 here and 20 here. So it's computed using simulations, of course. And so the purity is the most important thing, because we don't want that people look to these candidates and find nothing. So it's more important to have good candidates. We can do cosmology with the clusters. So it's done with a subset of clusters, more than 400, because we need to have the redshift, but also a good estimation of the mass with lensing. Here is a constraint from the CMB, and here from the lensing, with the three different ways to compute the mass. And you see that there is a tension between CMB and clusters, but also between the different ways to compute the mass. So it's probably mainly an astrophysical issue, and there is no really problem. In particular, if you compare the green part with the black one, you have no problem at all. For the first time, we provide the diffuse SZ emission. So it's a Y parameter, which quantifies the SZ effect, which is proportional, as I said, to the number of the electrons and their temperature. And so here you have a view from the south and north ecliptic pole. So of course there is a mask, is a comma and a Virgo, the two main clusters of the northern hemisphere. And there is a dedicated component separation which has been used, in fact two of them, to preserve the SZ effect and to remove properly the CMB. It's done simultaneously in the pixel and in the spectral domain using the very specific spectral characterization. And we had also to compare with the results from the catalog, and it works pretty well. We can do cosmology also with this map. So here it's in red, it's the spectrum of the SZ effect computed from this map after foreground subtraction. Here you have 2 points from Atacama and SPT, from ACT and SPT. And in gray, it sees the nuisance factor which is used in the CMB analysis. So it should be perhaps improved, but it's in agreement. And here you have the value of sigma 8 multiplied by a fraction of omega m. In blue, in cyan with the CMB, and two values for the clusters depending on the assumption you do on the astrophysical part, the bias. So as you see, it's mainly an astrophysical issue. The problem is that the simulations and so on say that it should be this one, but many things are still to understand. So the standard cosmological model, Planck was designed to test it, and we found no hint of a deviation from this model, precise cosmological parameters, and some constraint on the inflation model. Now for the future, just to conclude the quest of the gravitational waves. So I'm sure you have heard about the announcements from BICEP that they found the B-modes. So this is their map, which is beautiful. They found B-modes. The problem is the origin of these B-modes. And there was an alert from Planck a few months later. So here is the same as before way to show the map. You see the size of the pixels. It gives you an idea of the fact that the signal is really small. We have to use huge pixel to do it. And so it is the galactic signal translated in cosmological signal. And it's good when it's dark blue, and you see that in the BICEP area it was not dark blue, and here R equal to 0.2 was light green. So there was a collaboration between Planck and BICEP Keck, and this is the area from the 353 gigahertz channel in the BICEP 2 area, and you see very well the structure of the polarization signal and translated in spectrum. Here you have in black you have the bicep cake points. In blue, when you subtract the part of the dust, and in red, what you expect from the gravitational lensing, from what they see in scalar mode and in temperature, and you do not see any excess anymore. So the last figure, just our observable universe in polarization. So we really would like to see the gravitational waves to know where inflation happens exactly, the energy scale, but we have to deal also with our galaxy. Thank you.
You know, you mentioned that the there was this thermal calibration difference between Fermilab and Planck that was resolved a year ago. Is there going to be a similar issue for polarization? Is there some way of comparing the WMAP and Planck polarizations to get a sense as to whether or not you're seeing the same thing?
WMAP has not delivered a map in polarization now. I think the noise is too important. They have the spectrum in TE, but only that the first release, they provide a map of polarization and never more. So I assume that it's not so easy. Now the signal is 100 times lower, so it's difficult. But we still have the error bars, of course, the statistical error bars are not so bad, but it is the first time that, in fact, in polarization, we are dominated by systematic errors too. Astrophysical systematics, instrumental systematics, and so it's much more complicated. But
maybe why don't we break for lunch, and then if there's more discussion, we have it there.
Thank you.